Canto 10, text 27, chapter 27, text 9. Tavataroyam adhok sajeha.
Tavataroyam adhok sajeha.
Bhuvo varanam murubhara janmana. Chamupatinam Bhagavaya Deva. Bhavaya Yushmak Charananu Vartanam. Tavavataro Yamaduksa Jeha. Bhuvo Varanam Murubhara Janmanam. Chamupatinam Avavaya Deva. Bhavaya Yusmach Charananu Vartinam. Tavavataro Yamadoksa Jeha. Bhuvo Varanam Urubhara Janmanam. Chamupatinam Abhavaya Deva. Bhavaya Yas. Yusmach Charananu Vartinam.
Tavavataro Yamadoksa Jeha.
Tavavataro Yamadoksa Jeha.
Bhavaya Yusmach Charananu Vartinam.
Adhoksija, O transcendental Lord, Iha, into this world, Bhuva, of the earth, Bharanam, who constitute a great burden, Urubara, to many disturbances, Janmanam, who have given rise, Chamupatinam, of military leaders, Abhavaya, for the destruction, Deva, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhavaya, for the auspicious benefit, Yushmat, your Charana, lotus feet, Anuvartinam, for those who serve. Translation: You descend into this world, O transcendent Lord, to destroy the warlords who burden the earth and create many terrible disturbances. O Lord, you simultaneously act for the welfare of those who faithfully serve your lotus feet. Let's repeat. You descend into this world, O transcendent Lord, to destroy the warlords who burden the earth and create many terrible disturbances. O Lord, you simultaneously act for the welfare of those who faithfully serve your lotus feet. Purport. This verse utilizes an attractive poetic device. Lord Krishna's descent into this world is said to be for the abhav, literally non-existence or destruction of the demoniac warlords, and simultaneously for the bhav, or existence and prosperity, of those who faithfully serve the Lord's lotus feet. So there's two things here that he is saying, this abhav and bhav. One is meant for the demoniac and one is meant for the devotees. True existence, indicated here by the word bhav, is satchit ananda, eternal and full of bliss and knowledge. To an uninformed observer it may appear that Sri Krishna is simply rewarding his followers and punishing his enemies in the way that an ordinary person might do. That's pretty logical, that people, they give to their friends and they take from those who don't like them or who they don't like or who are inimical to them. So this is quite standard. This specific doubt about the Lord is raised extensively in the sixth canto, in connection with Krishna's taking the side of the faithful demigods against the faithless demons in a particular cosmic war. In that canto, the Vaishnava authorities clearly explain that in fact Lord Krishna is the father and lord of all living beings, and that all his activities are therefore meant for the benefit of all existence. He's not partial, in other words. Some people have a conception of God. We all have a conception. We haven't got the opportunity to see him with these very eyes because he doesn't agree to be seen with these fleshy eyes. He doesn't come within their jurisdiction. For if he was to come within the jurisdiction of our eyes, that would mean that our eyes took a superior position to him. Just like we examine so many things. I may pick up this book and look at it carefully to see if it is the right canto that I'm looking at. And I may notice that it's a little worn and torn, and I might think something, and I might, by my connection with this book, I might have a whole series of thoughts occur, in which it is me examining the nature of the book that puts my analytical power in a superior position to the book. Just like if you take a magnifying glass, you can look down on the book and see, oh, you can magnify this and so on. You can manipulate the book, its pages, you can put them into a photocopy machine, you can edit them, you can do so many things. You can move them around at your desire. But Krishna doesn't come under this, the jurisdiction of the living entity. So therefore, it is difficult because we cannot see him by this same process, which is the standard process used, practically speaking, by everyone for everything. This is how we live life. So how can we understand him? We can't use our senses in this particular way. So this is a dilemma. And practically, therefore, everyone has a conception. Just like if we hear on the roof some loud noise. If we were, for example, locked in this room, we couldn't leave the room at our free will to go and see what it was on the roof. Somebody might say, oh, that's a branch rubbing against the top of the roof. You listen very carefully, you can hear where it scratches. That's what it is. And someone else may say, no, that's a person. You listen, you can hear the steps on the roof. And another person may say, I think it's a cat. And everyone can give their conjectures. This means their conception of what is taking place up there. And because we cannot go out, we are in this particular analogy, we're locked in here, we may even disagree with each other's conception and say, so many times I've heard this sound, and in fact somebody has told me, and I've really thought deep about this. And you listen to the beat, beat, beat of the sound, and we can go on and on and on. And this can become a very interesting subject. It can take our minds even off the boredom of being locked in this room. We can put all our attention on what is this up on the roof. But in reality, all we can come to is a concept, our idea. It may be an educated guess, but it's still only in the form of a guess. So everyone has their conception of God, and within their conception, very often, if you examine the different religions of this world, and you see how much they fight with each other, you can understand that their primary conception includes some partiality. That God, he considers us the best. And because he considers us the best, not only perhaps the best, but the only religion, the only way to approach him. So therefore, because he considers us the best and only, we should either convert everyone to our religious faith or kill them. And practically speaking, you see this worldwide today. And then religion gets a bad name because, oh look, you become religious and you fight with each other. So this comes about when one's conception is not large enough, it's not broad enough to actually accommodate the nature of God properly. So a conception may arise from hearing that Krishna favors those who are faithful and he comes to destroy those who are warlords, that he has a partiality here. But he's saying, no, he is the Father and Lord of all living beings and that all his activities are therefore meant for the benefit of all existence. Krishna does not really cause the non-existence of anyone. There's an interesting concept. He doesn't cause the non-existence. What does it mean to non-exist? What do we think of when we think of somebody non-existing?
Death.
Death, yes. Death is the non-existence of this, of the body and soul in the form that we know it. What else?
Still having, not being manifested.
Not being manifest, something that hasn't happened yet. We think of that doesn't exist. What else? Something formless that has no form. You can't identify form to it. But then the argument would be that the air has no form, but you can perceive its existence. So what else do we think of when we think of something that doesn't exist, non-existence?
That we can't see.
That we can't see, it doesn't exist. a lot of people think that when somebody dies, they don't believe in, for example, ghosts and so forth, souls and so forth, because they can't see them. Also, sometimes you can take something and you can totally reduce it, completely take it and smash it to pieces, and it can be said it doesn't exist anymore because now it's only particles. But in reality, it's still in existence. It's just been transformed. So Krishna does not really cause the non-existence of anyone, but rather he curbs the foolish, destructive, material ways of those who defy the laws of God. These laws are created to ensure the prosperity, harmony, and happiness of the entire creation, and their violation is an unjustifiable disturbance. Now, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives us an insight into why Indra is making this little part of his prayer. His prayers are taking, I think, altogether up to Mother Saravi begins to speak. So he speaks up to text 13. So he's spoken all of these prayers. And his purpose, of course, is to seek the forgiveness for what he's done. But he's not, according to the Acharyas, 100% sincere. Because a person who's 100% sincere, there's no conditions. He just feels absolutely terrible and just doesn't know what to do, and I'm just so sorry. And there's a kind of a simplicity in the apology, because you've been so smashed that you don't feel like making anything clever. You just want to be forgiven. But Indra is very clever, so he's manipulating here through his prayers. So here he is explaining that there are so many warlords, and you come, they're proud and arrogant and strong, and you come to destroy them. But I'm not like that, because he's not like that. He's not in that category. He's not an angry, belligerent warmonger. He's just a person who's become very, very infatuated with his position and lost his sense. And then he says, you've also come for the welfare of those who are faithfully serving you. And he feels also that I certainly don't fit into that category right now either. So he finds himself a little categoryless. So he's glorifying, you do this and you do this. Certainly Indra was hoping that Krishna would count him amongst the devotees and not the demons. Although considering Indra's action, one might doubt where his loyalties actually lay. Indra was aware of this possible doubt, and thus we find in the next verse, he tried his best to surrender to the Supreme Lord. So he'll continue with his prayers. Now there's some words in this verse that are meant to give us a better conception of who is God. And because we tend to carry the concept that we have, it either expands or limits the degree of our surrender. If we have an idea of God that's not very attractive, then quite naturally we're not going to be able to give him very much. And if we have an idea of God that's a limiting one, then we're going to feel some fear that perhaps he's not really going to take proper care of me. So I should, certainly I should do my duty, and I should hope that he'll take care of me, but the possibility, the lack of faith may exist that he won't. So in the 10th canto, we were speaking of this yesterday, this is the verse that I was referring to yesterday. In the 10th chapter, Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is speaking to Krishna, having heard from him those very important key verses where Krishna tells him what is his mercy, how merciful he is. And we studied these verses quite carefully at the farm during the retreat. My husband was presenting with the Photoshop, so you can see some of these verses at the same time as hearing. We went over these nutshell verses. And after that, Arjuna responds. And there is two verses. And the verse that I was referring to yesterday, we spoke about this verse. The verse goes, Swayam evatman atmanam vetatvam purushottama Bhuta Bhavana Bhuteshu Deva Deva Jagatpate. And interestingly, you see here that one of the words that is used in this verse is this word Deva, O Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this word Bhava comes in also. It is also relevant for the auspicious benefit of Bhavaya. So in this verse, Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice description. He describes how there are three aspects. We've heard this, of course, many times, that there are three aspects to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to God. One is, and people are very attracted to this one, often the Buddhism and the impersonalism, wants to understand or have an approach to God through the concept that His spirit is everywhere. Spirit, everything is actually spirit. And if we remove the ignorance, we would see Him everywhere, in spirit. We would see that everything is one, it's one eternal, all blissful, spiritual existence. This is the stage of Brahman realization. Then after that, for the common man, you can say the Paramatma is there, that God is within the heart. So if he only knows that much, that God is in his heart, he knows God is in my heart. He knows I have a connection with God in my heart. He may even expand up to the level of saying that God is within everyone's heart. And that may be the end of his understanding. This is Paramatma realization. And this form of the Lord, as we hear from the Vedic literatures, isn't complete. That's a little bit, we think, isn't complete? God is complete. How can you say he's incomplete? This means that it is not a full manifestation of his completeness. Just like Srila Prabhupada gives us the example that if there is a carnival going on, or a parade, or a festival, policemen are asked to come, and maybe they police this event so there may be no disturbances, and they take to check everything, and everything is under their supervision. But after the festival or parade is complete, they go. So do they then not have any existence? Or do they go? Where do they go? So similarly, that God is within our heart, this is not, somebody can have this understanding and not still understand God's personality. So such a person should try to understand the Supreme Person from Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken by Krishna. So sometimes people do try to understand Krishna, but they don't have a clear understanding of his authority. So what is his authority? What is his jurisdiction, in other words? Would anyone can tell me what is his power of authority? He's a supreme authority. What does that mean? We break that down.
He has no
jurisdiction. He has full jurisdiction. No jurisdiction. He has everything under his authority. What were you saying? He has no authority.
He's all-powerful.
He's all-powerful. Can you explain yourself? He has no authority.
He
has no authority above him, you're saying? Yeah. Yes, he has no authority above him. He is...
He's all-powerful, all-intelligent.
So this concept is there in Christianity also. We have the words omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. The sense Latin words that are also applied here to God. So yes, he's the supreme authority. But yet, many people who understand he's the supreme authority, now you have to think, because we already know the end, because Prabhupada has told us, but if you think for a while, there are many people who accept, yes, he's omnipotent, omniscient, everything, but they may not understand, they cannot understand perhaps that he is the supreme person. Because if he has no authority, where do we see a man of this world who has no authority? Everyone has somebody above them. So they may not attribute personality to him. They might think that he's something vague. He's a power, but not a person. A person means we're saying he has no jurisdiction or he has no limitation. So as soon as you measure something, you're limiting it. It exists in this space right here. It doesn't exist there, it doesn't exist there. So this conception of God that we have to say he's not limited. That means he can't exist just right there. He has to exist everywhere. So how can he be a person? Does he have black hair, brown hair, green eyes, blue eyes? Is he friendly? Is he bad-tempered? What is he like? I don't like all kinds of people. What sort of person is he? Tell me. And practically speaking, if you say then yes, well, he's a beautiful bluish color. Why blue? People will ask. Why? Why a color? Why this? Why that? Why? You're saying that you just said he has no jurisdiction. He's absolutely everywhere. And now you're giving him these limitations. So they may not be able to understand God's personality. Therefore, here, Arjuna has used the word Purushottam. It was very calculated, the word he used. Purush Uttam, the supreme person. Uttam Purush. So then one may still not understand. Yes, he's a person. Okay, God is a person. But then one may not be able to understand that he is the father of everyone. So a father automatically means that the children came from the father. So he could be, I can think he could be my father, but what about the murderer and the horrible people of this world? What about the animals? What about the amoebas? What about the imperceptible, so tiny living entities, they're almost molecular. How is he their father? And the elephants and the birds and the trees? So one may not understand this. We may not understand this. We probably would have to say that we don't understand this. So therefore Arjuna is using a word. He says, Bhuta Bhavana. And in this word, in this particular verse, this word Bhuta comes in. Indra is also using the same word. He says, you are Bhuva Bharanam. You are the one who removes the burden of this earth. So he's also trying to give an elaboration on who is Krishna. He's trying to glorify him by describing him. And as we hear these words, if we try to let them enter into our intelligence, they can make an expansion of our conception, or they can eradicate some of the improper speculations that we have developed into our understanding of God, and they can expand it. And then, if we hold this for a moment, and we go about our daily activities, then Krishna, who is within the heart, I'm seated within everyone's heart, from me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. He can accommodate us with some realization of how this is applicable to us, not how it's just a theoretical subject matter for learning or memorization, or perhaps not even that. But it's something that we need to know to grow. So yes, he's the father of all living entities. Somebody may know that he's the father of all living entities, but he still may not know that he is the supreme controller. So think for a moment, if your conception, okay, he's the father, God the father, then he must have a long beard, right? He certainly doesn't shave in the heavens above. They don't require these kind of contraptions. So he has a long beard, he's my father. But that doesn't satisfy, it's inadequate as well. And not only that, my father and everyone's father here, my father wasn't able to stop the forces of time that resulted in his passing from this world. So he certainly was a very nice man. He was my father. He did this, or some people in Kali Yuga will have to look at their father and say, my father was not a very nice man. So if I think God is my father, I don't like my father, I don't like him. So why? Because your father was like this, your father was like that. Your father was not what? The supreme controller. He's an authority, but you can find authorities in this world. There are authorities on the Vedas, authorities on this and that, but they're not the supreme controller. So here it goes further. Yes, he's a person. He's the authority, but he's a person. He's the supreme person. Not only is he the Supreme Person, he's the Father, not only of you or me, of everyone. Not only is he that, he's the Supreme Controller. Therefore, he is addressed as Bhutesh, or the Supreme Controller of everyone. Is that enough? Prabhupada says, even if one knows that Krishna is the Supreme Controller of all living entities, still one may not know that he is the origin of the demigods. You may say that he's the Father, but you may think the demigods, Lord Shiva, especially this is very important for the Indian community, because Westerners don't even know about demigods. So when you tell them about demigods, they'll accept whatever you say, because it was not a subject they grew up with. But in India, people think, yes, there is Vishnu, he is this, he is that, he's the Supreme Controller. But their conception runs a leak when it comes to who the demigods, they are actually under his control. And therefore he is called Deva Deva. And here you hear also he's saying, oh Deva, you are the master. But here he's saying, you are the master, he's a demigod, but he has forgotten that he's Deva Deva. He's the master of the demigods, I'm a demigod, he's my master, I should honor that. So then, the last one that is added to this list is, even if you say that he has all these positions, you may still not know that he is the supreme proprietor of everything. He owns everything. So he owns everything. He's the origin of the demigods, they come from him. He's the father of everyone, especially we can think he's my father, but he's everyone's father. He's in control of everything, he's the supreme person and the supreme authority. So if at any time you feel worried or doubtful or confused or restless or any other aspect of life that is disturbing to your devotional thought, then go through these in your mind and you'll see that Krishna is going to take care of you on all levels. And you should surrender to him on all levels because of his absolute position. And try to remove some of the ignorance in the conception that is formed by a lack of experience in the material world. Now, Indra is going to start offering his glorification in the next two prayers. So we will start these two tomorrow, where he starts to, by these prayers, now he's offering, you could say, his obeisances. He has been a little worried up until now that Krishna may be waiting to punish him, because he's thinking to himself, he's taken care of the residents of Vrindavan very nicely by lifting Govardhan, but he hasn't actually given me any punishment yet, and certainly I deserve it. So before he does that, let me first of all beg for his mercy and say, please, if you punish me, it won't really work, because it won't change my heart as much as your mercy will change my heart. So please give me your mercy instead, because you are all of these wonderful aspects. This is all your virtues and qualities. So please count me not as a demon, a demoniac one, because I have done such a cruel and heartless thing, but place me amongst your devotees. So needless to say, we will hear where Krishna will ask him a few questions about his devotional merits and ask him why he did this. If you're a devotee, why did you do this? Why did you do this terrible thing? So we will hear tomorrow Indra's answers to this, why he did it. And then we can learn some more about, perhaps by watching Indra go through this humiliating situation, we can perhaps learn something for our own little microcosmic experiences of the similar nature. Does anyone have any questions?
I have one comment. When Krishna said, I am Sarvas Prabhu, I am the source of everything, material and spiritual, so there is no question of doubting anything. He is saying himself is Bhagavad Gita.
Yes.
And I am the source of everything, material and spiritual.
Yes.
And so he is a father, supreme father.
But you see, the mind, the nature of the human mind is to doubt. So we hear something and then we think, yes, but, and we go about our life or whatever and we forget it. So Krishna, over and over and over, he's dealing with Arjuna in that way. Arjuna will say, yes, I fully accept this, and then he will ask a question that seems to be an unsuitable question for one who has fully accepted Krishna as he is. So the purpose for doing that is because Krishna could have said immediately, you just do whatever I say. And Arjuna most likely would have done that, but we wouldn't. So therefore he goes backwards and forwards with his questions or doubts to remove particles of disloyal inclinations bit by bit. So yes, and he will speak again to Arjuna and say, when Arjuna says, can you show me your opulences? He's not speaking out of doubt himself, but out of the doubtfulness of the conditioned soul's heart. He's representing that. So can you show me? You've said you're this, you're this, you're this. Can you show me? And so Krishna says, first of all, yes, I am this, I am this, I am this. See me like this. And Arjuna still persists and says, can you show me? And in the 11th canto, he says, yes, I can even show you. So you can see it with your eyes. Not only you can hear it, but you can see it. But you need special eyes for this. So he says, I will give you those eyes, and then you can see how I am pervading all of nature. And Arjuna becomes quite horrified when he sees the powerful aspect of his supreme friend. He doesn't actually like it, but he pushes on and asks, can I see you in your forearm form? He sees this, and then he returns to his form as Krishna. And Arjuna is actually quite shocked by what he has just seen. This is all for our benefit, so that we can understand the truth, the substance of Krishna consciousness. It's not just a theoretical presentation. It seems that way because the whole world is working in a different way, but it isn't. So we need this doubt and removal of doubt constantly for our own benefit. Any other points?
Yeah. In what cases is that bewilderment their own bewilderment, and in what cases is it kind of directly arranged by Krishna? Like Arjuna is bewildering himself and explaining directly arranged by Krishna.
Yes.
Like Jesus' case or other people's cases, how do we know it's directly arranged by Krishna or it's just their own faulty going about?
Well, I think the only way we can, you could say, interpret what's taking place is through the words and through the vision given by liberated, exalted souls who actually have the power to penetrate into these mysteries, not by the processes I was describing of putting God on paper and then analyzing, moving things around to your intellect's powerful content, but who have vision. Because Krishna says to those who are constantly devoted, worship me with love, I give the understanding. So it has to be a gift. So they're gifted. And so we listen to them. And many times we read Srila Prabhupada's purports, you'll see, say, in a particular pastime, in one verse you'll point out the folly of this person. In the next verse you'll point out, even in the Bhagavad Gita this is there, you'll point out how illumined and exalted the person is. In the next verse you'll point out again the foolishness of this particular person. So I don't think it's a simple thing to understand this when it comes, especially when it comes to this canto, the 10th canto, because these personalities are entering into Vrindavan to perform these activities that appear foolish. So I cannot give you the proper answer to that. Perhaps I can look up and see what, if there's something that's complete as an answer. But generally, as I said, to bring out the flavor of the pastime, you've got to see that they made a mistake. If you always know, oh, they're just faking it, they don't really feel like that. They never ever see anything. They never make a mistake. And we're down here and we always make mistakes and they never make mistakes. Where is the bridge between the two? So they're placed forward by Krishna's arrangement to make their errors. But how much they're actually grossly covered by ignorance it must be there to some, on some level, at least with Indra, because, but who are we to say that at the same time?
That's not the way so clearly described, whether it's in your case or somehow.
Well, the acharyas seem quite comfortable with calling Indra foolish, you know, and malicious and angry and so many things. And Indra feels quite comfortable to call himself these things too. But we still can't, we can't do it, if you know what I mean. As if we have a superior position, we can't do it. We can repeat what they're saying in this example. But it probably would become somewhat of one of the non-apparats to offend these persons, because after all, we just heard, what was the name of Krishna? Does anyone remember? Yes, Deva, Deva, Jagat, and then he's Jagatpati. He's the Lord of the universe, but he's Deva, Deva. He's the origin of the demigods. So it's a little mysterious in that regard. Yes, Prabhu.
In the same line, I'm just wondering how also it works in the concept. Krishna comes, and then there's a whole range of activities that take place, not only because of his presence, but because of the situation. So it seems, you know, you could think of, okay, now I'm here. Are you going to make, are you going to make a mistake sort of the past time when you perform, or you just happen to make that mistake?
When it comes to us, you're saying?
Your condition, and therefore I have a past time according to your faulty behavior.
You're talking about us now, or
is it because Krishna is there that they are going to have faulty behavior, or it was going to happen anyway and Krishna performed the pastime accordingly?
No, it was Krishna is the first. Because if you remember, if you go to another aspect of this lila, they go on over and over and over and over again in different universes. So there has to be a Kamsa in order to be Krishna's lila to go to Vrindavan. So Narada Muni, now there's an exalted person, he glorifies, he sees these personalities as wonderful, Kamsa and so forth, because without Kamsa, Krishna wouldn't have performed his Vrindavan lila. And also you can see that a writer, when they're writing a book, I remember one time speaking to a friend who liked to write and suggesting to them, can you write something? Why not write about this? And they said, there's not enough conflict in it. And I myself remember learning this in school writing, that an interesting piece has to have a conflict in it. In fact, last night I was reading Back to Godhead magazine, and the very first paragraph of a particular article talked about somebody in a difficult situation, and it was an autobiographical, and then it went on to describe their life, and I read the whole thing trying to find out more about this first paragraph. What was it? Because it didn't explain it very clearly, and this is a writer's technique. So you're reading, trying to find what was the context in which you were in that situation. So there has to be some, to make drama, there has to be conflict, there has to be some tension there. And then the overcoming of that tension. So there have to be negative elements to glorify the positive. If Krishna didn't leave Vrindavan, how would we know how exalted the gopis' love is? Because the pinnacle of their love is what they do when he leaves. And not only that, look at the way he leaves. He says, I'm coming back. I'll be back tomorrow, don't worry, I'm just coming back now. He cheats them in that sense. And they've given everything to him. Everything, every particle of themselves they've given. They've defied all social behavior, everything. And then he leaves them.
So where is the room for spontaneity and unexpectation?
Every time the lila takes place, it's different. It never happens in the same way. Isn't that inconceivable? Because if they're going on eternally, then they never happen in the same way. For example, sometimes Kaliya, right, Krishna chastises him and sends him off. Sometimes he keeps him and he uses him and he rides him. He goes to Mathura on Kaliya. There's so much room for spontaneity, because that's the essence of the Leela, is the spontaneous, the loving reciprocation. There's hardly any spontaneity here, because we're dictated by the modes. We get certain modes at birth and they dictate and they push us in particular ways. We feel that we make spontaneous choices. But if you were to, if somebody was to take you in some sort of a magical time aeroplane back and look over your whole life, you'd see how many things you've been doing it that way since you were little, and you still do it that way because there's a conditioning. But they're free of conditioning. It's quite inconceivable. They're free of conditioning, but they're not bored. They're not thinking, oh, now I'm this, eternally I'm this, I would rather be that. If they did think like that, they could be that. They have all the freedom in the whole world there. There's only spontaneity there. And yet, it happens regularly. Time doesn't act in a forceful way there. Time acts to facilitate the loving exchanges between Krishna and his devotees. This is the difference between the spiritual time and material time.
So, I guess it's the same with the idea of, for example, the yugas, like Kali Yuga is meant to be dark.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that Krishna thinks, well, no matter how you behave, it's going to have to be dark. There's the potential to turn it around also.
Yes. But who can turn around the potential to turn it around is given by, it's like cradled by the acharyas, like Srila Prabhupada. They empower you with the potential to turn it around, but only as to the degree that Krishna wants to have it turned around. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is there. So we're never free to just turn anything around that we want, because we're so tiny. But yes, the potential to turn it around is there. It's not like as if it's all written, the play's all written, the end is there, and we just have to sort of lead a mindless, you know, part. We can. We have an influence. It's not predestiny in the sense that some people think of in Indian philosophy. Chandra.
As you mentioned, the pastime is happening again and again and again, yeah, with Kamsa and so on. Mm. Is it the case that the same soul continuously accepts that particular position again and again and again?
As far as I understand it, is.
Even for the demoniac person, so I'm
told. As far as I understand it, is. I've never explored that thought, but as far as I understand it, is. But it isn't that by doing that somebody's kind of typecast forever eternally into a horrible role, because by the end of this of the Leela they become liberated. So then we would think in our material way, we think, oh, you mean that they got up and then they fall down again and again? It's not quite like that, because they're eternally in association with Krishna. So the Krishna factor makes the experience totally outside what we could understand for ourselves. Any other questions? Yes.
As I mentioned today, I haven't been here for the last few days. As Guru Jan Prabhu mentioned, that some of the commentaries were made by Sridhar or
Sridhar Swami.
Sridhar Swami, Dhanarasi.
Sridhar, yes.
I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about him.
I don't know so much about him. I'm sure you could find information about him. I think he was in the maybe in the 13th, 14th century, something like that. And he is in the there's four sampradayas. I think I shouldn't guess. But I know he's not in the Brahma Sampradaya, but there are four bona fide Vaishnava lines, and he's the prominent acharya in one of them. And he has the most prominent, well-read, respected commentary on the Bhagavatam. So maybe my husband can research, if you ask him that question, more about Sridhar Swami.
Thank you.
I have heard something, but it's not returning to my memory at this moment. And yeah, yes.
Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is gradually explaining about himself and the spiritual goal, and wants everybody who is reading the Bhagavad Gita to bring him back to the spiritual world.
Yes. Yes.
In the 18th chapter, he says that just surrender unto me and become my devotee.
Yes.
I want to know that will there be any time in the the whole creation that every single entity will be aware of Krishna and will be will be fully conscious of Krishna, so that it will end up
a material world. Well, if you think just practically, like, you know, not from some exalted level, in a kingdom, even a good king who has obedient citizens, he does have a prison house. It's a facility that every kingdom has. He may have a small prison because he may have very, very, very unlikely to have crime there, but he has it just in case. So I would say that there will always be a material facility there for the living entities who wish to take advantage of it. So it would seem as though if that option is made available, and it has to be made available for the freedom of the living entities, it's likely that some people will take advantage of it. Your question sort of presupposed in my mind as if God would come through and clean everybody up and straighten them all up and then let them all out. But that seems to take away from the fact that they have to do that themselves. They have to rectify. There's a rectification has to begin with their willingness to be rectified rather than his power upon them. So Krishna doesn't do that. He doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity. So it's unlikely that he will do that. Does that make sense?
It's just a big play going on with Govinda, and then Krishna instructs them through his representatives or himself, and then he wants again them to come back.
Not exactly. It's a little simplified. It's, you know, we're talking about atoms. I mean, universes. We're not talking about something, just a little something. It's a vast inconceivability that's taking place. If you just go to the city and say, this is just a little something, you'll find it's not a little something. It's a very complex mechanism, the city of Melbourne. Very sophisticated, very, very elaborate. And this is just one tiny, tiny city. Or to speak of all the cities of the world, or to speak of all the worlds, all the universes, all the planets. It's far from just, it's an extraordinary arrangement. So it's hard to take everything in a very elaborate arrangement and put it under the heading, this is just a, did it. Right. Yes, to rectify.
So there are like innumerable universes that we come to know from the study of Bhagavad.
Yes.
So he descends in every single universe of existence.
What does he say? What does he say? Does anyone know his words? What is the translation of that?
Every yuga I come, every millennium I come, whenever there is a degradation of the medium.
So he says, whenever, wherever, whenever. So that is his, these are his words. All right, any other? Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.